Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a report just out from the Federal Reserve that finds the recent economic crisis erased two decades of accumulated prosperity from America's middle class. Mattia Kramer, a research analyst with the National Priorities Project, joins us to discuss why, while the middle class's wealth has been eviscerated, in 2011 the federal government handed a $4.4 billion housing subsidy to the top 1% of Americans. Then we'll examine whether the Republicans are deliberately crashing the U.S. economy to defeat Obama and the Democrats and help elect Romney and more Republicans. Michael Cohen, a fellow at the Century Foundation and a columnist at Foreign Policy, where he covers politics and national security, joins us. He has an article in the UK Guardian that is attracting a lot of attention. Did Republicans deliberately crash the US economy? Then finally, after a second day of devastating testimony from young victims against the former Penn State football coach, we will speak with the co-authors of a new book, Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State and the Culture of Silence. Bill Mushi, a former crime reporter with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Bob Vorchak, a veteran sports reporter, join us to explain how the Mother Teresa of Happy Valley was able to avoid prosecution for so long. Joining us now is Mattia Kramer, who is a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. They are just releasing a new book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mattia Kramer.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And the Federal Reserve on Monday released this report titled The Survey of Consumer Finances that found that two decades of accumulated prosperity was erased from the middle class, and the medium middle class family's net worth of $77,300 in 2010 compares with $126,400 in 2007. It's just incomprehensible to me that at a time when we just learn from the Federal Reserve what's happened and how the middle class has been devastated, that you've come up with this finding that in 2011, the federal government handed a $4.4 billion housing subsidy to the top 1% of Americans?
Yeah, that's through a very popular provision in our tax code called the home mortgage interest deduction. And it's it turns out it's incredibly regressive. So a lot of the benefits of that very popular policy actually go to wealthy Americans who can get a tax break when they buy second or third homes or even classify a yacht as a home for tax benefits. And in total, you're exactly right, it amounted to $4.4 billion in a housing subsidy, and that's for the wealthiest 1% alone. It's about $17 billion if you look at the wealthiest 20% of Americans.
But the Federal Reserve report finds that the disproportion in the wealth of the middle class is mostly in housing. And the median amount of home equity dropped from $75,000 in 2010, dropped to $75,000 in 2010 from $110,000 in 2007. And this is where most of the wealth of the middle class is, in their houses.
That's exactly right. And while nobody's surprised at this point to hear that middle class wealth is declining, that's about a 40% decline, and nearly 40%. That's a huge number, and it's most of all driven by that decline in home prices.
So I'm just astounded, Mattia, about how the report finds that the share of families with education related debts rose to 19.2% from 2010 from 15.2% in 2007, and that education loans make up a larger share of the average family's obligations than loans to buy automobiles. And this is for the first time in the history of the survey. So this is the way that you really look into the DNA of the disproportion of wealth in this country, surely.
Yeah, this may be the most important finding, right? Because we're probably not surprised that middle class wealth is declining, but to hear these kinds of increases in education loans, and that education loans now exceed automobile loans, points to something really important, which is that if folks can no longer afford higher education, and this report also found that Americans are saving less, right, and including saving less for education, if people can no longer afford higher education, that means we're only going to see greater inequality, because our higher education system has been one of our great equalizers. So this bodes badly for future reports as well.
Well, a part of the reason why the education costs are going up is that student loan costs are going up, and that's because the federal government is loaning money to a lot of these for-profit colleges where they get tax dollars for nothing and then loan them back to students at an enormous interest rate, giving them saddling them with a lifetime of debt while providing them with worthless diplomas.
And it's important to note that as the federal government is spending billions of dollars on this housing subsidy for wealthy Americans, that is money that we could choose as taxpayers, as the American people, to instead invest in higher education, right? That's money that could just as easily go toward higher education, which would be a long-term investment in the middle class. So we can choose, as an American people, to move that money from a housing subsidy for the wealthy into tuition support for higher education. That's a choice that's possible to make.
Again, I'm speaking with Mattia Kramer, who's a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. They are releasing a new book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. So, Mattia, tell me about the notion of as I mentioned, I think the federal budget is a sort of is the DNA of America's spending priorities, and the extent of which social justice and fairness in this country has gone askew. What's your sense of where will the tipping point come in outrage?
Well, I think student loan debt has brought us well on our way. The student loan burden has far exceeded historical standards and is bringing a powerful voting bloc into light, which is young people who don't vote in numbers that that are commensurate with potential. And so, if large numbers of young Americans start voting paying more attention to where tax dollars go and how spending priorities are influencing this country, that indeed could be the tipping point toward policies that look very different from the ones that we have right now.
Well, you'd think it would be a very, very, very personal and issue of fairness, given that young people are starting out in their careers. If they're laden down with so much debt, there's no way that they're going to get ahead. And this has not been the case up until recently.
That's right, and there have been remarkable studies about how our higher education system for most of the 20th century did incredible things to reduce income inequality in this country, and it's one of the things that has distinguished this country from our international peers. But that's no longer the case. It's less and less the case because there's less access to higher education because of spiraling tuition costs and lower returns to education given the high investment that's required. So it's endangering something that's been a core piece of American prosperity.
Well, I find it a little ironic, Mattia Kramer, that at the time when the Fed releases these brutal statistics on how the crash of 2008 sucker-punched America's middle class, at the same time, Senator Bernie Sanders has just released a report indicating how much the Fed has been lending, and he forced this information out into the daylight, how much the Fed has literally given away money at no interest to these large banks, including Jamie Dimon's bank, Citibank. Just billions and billions of dollars were lent out to these banks at no interest rate, as they were to a lot of big U.S. corporations.
Yes, it's very tricky. This stuff is Bernie Sanders is doing a service by bringing it into the daylight, and that's something that we're trying to do. We've just released this book, as you mentioned, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. It's crucial that people understand where their tax dollars are going and how our federal officials are acting supposedly on our behalf, because if we don't understand what they're up to, it's very difficult to hold them accountable, which is ultimately our job in this democracy.
Well, as again, the Fed's released these statistics, but not issued any kind of policy guidance or made any suggestions. And it just seems to me so odd that this report doesn't speak for itself. It's so damning.
Oh, absolutely. The fact that these banks get interest-free loans and there's no explanation about that, and as I mentioned earlier, the federal government faces trade-offs about what to do with our tax dollars, with the resources in federal coffers, and the policies that are in place now to support financial institutions, as you're mentioning, and even some corporations, do not reflect what are the priorities of Americans writ large.
So, do you think this report is going to get any attention from the White House, given that they're in this race? Apparently, from what I understand, the commercials that the White House did exposing Bain Capital as a kind of vulture capitalist operation really did gain some traction, and they clearly upset the Republicans in the Romney campaign. You would think, if there's any fairness left in the land, that this information would really, be something to get the middle class mobilized.
I hope you're right. I think that we're not likely to see much of note coming out of the White House following this report, but the emphasis should be on what happens in terms of getting the middle class mobilized, or that tipping point that we mentioned earlier in terms of what will it take to get folks involved, folks voting who aren't right now. This could certainly be a catalyst in that direction, and I'm hopeful in that regard.
Well, but it's the way to get the middle class mobilized is to start rewarding them and stop rewarding the 1% who don't need it. I mean, I just, again, I can't get over the idea that in 2011, the federal government, that means the average taxpayer, gave $4.4 billion in tax subsidies to America's top 1% so that they could claim deductions, claiming one of their yachts as a home.
Yeah, so that same deduction, the home mortgage interest deduction, it was worth on average, about $139 for the middle 20% of Americans. And so folks in the middle 20% or the middle class find this policy to be to their benefit. This is a popular policy. What they don't know is that the folks in the top 1% on average were getting more than $3,700 per taxpayer because of this same policy. So this is a regressive policy, yet still popular among the middle class. And so it really takes some transparency here in cracking open these numbers to show that to help catalyze the middle class to get folks motivated because of these very damning numbers.
Well, I'm grateful that you and your organization, the National Priorities Project, are doing this. I wish there were more politicians in this country speaking up for the middle class. It's just appalling to the statistics that have come out of this Federal Reserve report of how the net worth of the average middle class home has gone from $126,400 in 2007 down to $77,300 in 2010. That is a huge hit, and we have this myth that we're a middle-class country all pursuing the American dream. How do people get hold of A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, the new book you've...
Yeah, they should go to nationalpriorities.org. That's our website, our National Priorities Project website, and they'll see right away information about our new book. That's A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, and they'll also see lots of up-to-the-date federal budget information, up-to-the-minute reports about what's going on for folks who want to keep track of where their tax dollars go and understand when policies are not favoring the middle class and are, in fact, promoting inequality that's growing in this country.
And just in closing, have you noticed, is anybody on the Hill, apart from Bernie Sanders, are they picking up on one, the Federal Reserve report that came out on Monday about how the middle class's wealth has been eviscerated since the housing crash, and conversely, how the top 1% are being rewarded by government policy?
I haven't heard a word from a single lawmaker on the Hill, with the exception of Bernie Sanders. And lawmakers have stayed very quiet on the issue of these tax breaks, such as the home mortgage interest deduction, and they can hide behind the fact that they remain popular with the middle class, largely because folks don't know that their regressive policies mostly favoring our wealthy counterparts.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today.
Oh, a pleasure. A pleasure, as always, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mattia Kramer, a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. They are just releasing a new book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about how the Republicans are deliberately crashing the U.S. economy.
And every time you see them, they're styling and profiling. Always trying to get more than they give. Hold that little man down. Why don't they let him live? Ooh, let him live. I just because a rich kid for job and the poor.
How long to go before you reach all your selfish goals? Punchline after punchline, leaving us all, leaving us all.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, a fellow at the Century Foundation and a columnist at Foreign Policy, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. Previously, he served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for U.S. Representative to the United Nations, Bill Richardson, and Undersecretary of State, Stuart Eisenstadt. He was a chief speechwriter for Senator Chris Dodd and from 2006 to 2009 was a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you have an article at a piece in The Guardian, the UK Guardian, Did Republicans Deliberately Crash the U.S. Economy? And, of course, that is an extremely loaded question. There's been a considerable response to this article, has there not?
No, it's gotten quite an amazing response. I'm sort of surprised by it. And I think part of the response is because it strikes a nerve with a lot of people. You know, one of the things interesting in the article is I don't actually argue that they're purposely derailing the economy. I think there's a circumstantial argument to be made that they are. But, you know, they should be judged by their economic policies. And whether it's on purpose or simply a case of, you know, fiscal incompetence, their policies have been disastrous for the country and have contributed to a lot of the economic malaise that we're experiencing today.
But I'm always reminded of Jim Carville's adage from the Clinton campaign, it's the economy, stupid. And clearly, with uncertainty in Europe, and many have argued that Angela Merkel holds Barack Obama's re-election chances in her hands, and the latest figures indicate that the president is in trouble if it's the economy, stupid again, in 2012. At this point, I guess the question is, Michael Cohen, why hasn't the president come up with a narrative? I mean, CNN did a piece recently where they interviewed a focus group and they asked them, what is the Republican message? And everybody could quote exactly what the Republicans have been saying in the campaign and on the stump. And then they said, what's the Democratic message? And there was a deafening silence.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that it's tough as far as the Democrats to get a narrative out, because Republicans have one line and one line only, which is that Obama's responsible for how bad the economy is and he's to blame. But if you look, I think, deeper inside the poll numbers, I mean, they tell a more nuanced story. That about half of all Americans actually do believe that Republicans are deliberately trying to undercut the economic recovery. And still a majority of Americans tend to blame actually President Bush more than President Obama for the current state of the economy. I think, you know, that's cold comfort to the folks in Chicago who are planning Obama's reelection, because inevitably the president gets blamed for bad economic times. But, you know, he's got an argument to make here that this has been caused not just by his policies, but by Republican policies have made the situation worse. And I think that's an argument that will resonate with a good number of Americans. Whether it resonates with 50% point one, who knows? But I think it's unlike in previous years. It's an easier argument to blame the opposition party than before. You know, usually the president gets blamed for these things. That's just the way things go. But I think there's a lot of blame to go around here, and I think Obama can make the argument that it's not all his responsibility of how bad the economy is doing.
Well, his opponent is certainly making the opposite argument, that it is all of his responsibility, and that I, a successful businessman, are going to be the miracle worker here. So the question then is, why is Obama not, if the polls are on his side, as you've just mentioned, or at least up to a thin majority,
right.
You'd wonder why he doesn't do it. Or do you think, are we just being political junkies here, expecting too much too soon? After all, it's 6 months away, the election.
I think that's a little bit of it. I mean, it's early, you know, so there's still some time to sort of figure out what the right message is. But I think, you know, it's interesting this week that you had this sort of, first you had Obama say the private sector is doing fine, which caused a great deal of angst in the White House, and they tried to walk it back. But then Romney came out and said, you know, that it was good to cut firefighters and policemen and teachers and so forth, which kind of plays into Obama's key argument, which is that the biggest problem in the country is that we're not, you know, funding these public sector jobs that are very important to the recovery. So in a sense, you know, Romney sort of played into Obama's key argument. But I think your original point is correct. It's very early. It's hard to say what economic arguments are going to play. You know, there is some indication that this attack against Romney for his career at Bain resonated. It resonated with focus groups, resonated with in polls, that it's something that people are suspicious of about Romney. You know, and for the White House's sake, they have to find that silver bullet argument, because, you know, they're going to be dealing with 8% unemployment going into a reelection campaign, and that's going to be a challenge. It's going to restrict, you know, I think how well Obama can do. But there are plenty of ways to go after your opponent and to make your opponent seem like he's not up to the job of fixing the economy, and that's what they kind of have to do, I think.
Well, Michael Cohen, the fact that the unemployment's at 8.2, it would be around 7%, but for the shedding of jobs in state and local government. 611,000 jobs have been shed, and that is essentially what Obama was trying to say when he got into trouble this week. He was trying to say that, you know, compared to the public sector economy, the private sector economy is doing well. And I think, isn't there a case to be made here that this is a Republican strategy? And look what happened in Wisconsin. They're out to break the unions, public sector unions. That is, as a part of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council's model legislation. That's going apace. I mean, so, and there is a double motive here, at least we're led to believe, that not only are the Republicans determined to break public employees' unions, a part of the motive is that they're a source of income for the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, certainly the austerity programs that Republicans have forced, not just on the federal government, but on the states, have been disastrous. I mean, as you said, unemployment would be an entire point lower. And if you think of the residual effects of having more teachers, of having more social services on a state level, I mean, the economic impact is enormous, and it's enormous, and more enormous than just the jobs that are lost. But I find interesting is that, for example, policies that, you know, Republicans once supported as stimulus, they now oppose. They used to be supportive of a payroll tax. They fought Obama's payroll tax tooth and nail, begrudgingly agreeing to renew it earlier this year. They have in the past supported unemployment insurance. It hasn't been a controversial issue. Now Republicans have been fighting it for basically the 3.5 years of Obama's presidency. I mean, I kind of get, you know, I think it's hard to prove that this, that what's going on here is purposeful deliberation, purposeful blocking of an economic recovery. But the circumstantial argument is a strong one. But again, I think it's almost irrelevant if they're purposely doing it. Their economic policies are not working. And we are living at this point in America in what is a Republican economy of low taxes and of spending austerity. And that has brought us to where we are right now, which is having a rather mediocre recovery with continually high unemployment.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Cohen, a fellow at the Century Foundation, a columnist at Foreign Policy, a former speechwriter with the United States Department of State, and the author of an article in the UK Guardian, Did Republicans Deliberately Crash the US Economy? When you just said then, Michael, that we are living in a Republican economy, of course, that is not a campaign slogan that Obama can run on. It is an ironic fact, though, nevertheless, that if you're wealthy and if you're a Republican, you shouldn't have anything to complain about. The stock market's doing great. You know, the 1% are doing better than ever. I know that's not exactly what you meant by we're living in a Republican economy, but, you know, the tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts are in place, and the tax burden as a percentage of the GDP is at its lowest point since Harry Truman sat in the White House.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting here, I think, is that, you know, if you compare the economic policies of the president versus Republicans, the president put in place a stimulus plan that was way too small. I think most people agree with that, but did create, by I think pretty unanimous view of economists, create about 3 million jobs, about 3.5 million jobs. Republican policies, you know, since they took over Congress in 2011 and basically forced on the country, have not been stimulative at all. They've, in fact, been responsible for many of the cuts you see in the public sector. So in a sense, it's like I almost think, you know, it would be interesting to have a debate for the election, you know, not on this question of whether they purposely did this, but whether, you know, whose policies are better, for the long-term economic prospects of the country. And, you know, I think my opinion on this is pretty clear. But, you know, I think Republicans, you know, have gone and criticized Obama's economic policies, and that's legitimate to criticize them, but they should also bear some criticism as well. I mean, their policies and what they have done to the country and what they would do if they won the White House, I mean, should be assessed with greater rigor. And I think that's part of what, you know, what I was trying to get across in this piece is that if you want to look at the state of the economy and who's responsible for that, you have to look at the policies that are in place and which party is pushing those policies in the future, and that would be the Republicans. I think, you know, most people would agree that if Obama's Jobs Act had passed last fall, it would have created a great many jobs. It would have, you know, maybe increased deficit, but it certainly would have lowered unemployment. And I think that is an important element of, or should be an important element of our political debate.
Well, one of the things I find extraordinary is the difference between the Republicans and Democrats in the sense that in 2000, when the Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore gave the presidency to George W. Bush, when there was a great deal of evidence that he hadn't won, then the Democrats swallowed their indignation and allowed President Bush to govern, and they didn't keep questioning his legitimacy. You contrast to that what happened in 2008 with the election of Barack Obama with a huge majority, winning the Democrats won the House and the Senate and the White House, and from day one, the Republicans treated them as though, Obama, as though he was an interloper and a usurper and had no legitimacy.
Yeah, and of course, you know, this is a double win for them because on the one hand, they block everything Obama wants to do, and which, A, hurts him politically, helps them, energizes their base, but also sort of proves their underlying political argument, which is that government can never accomplish anything good. You know, so if you block government, you sort of win on both accounts. You block new programs, if it's the healthcare program, if it's more stimulus, you sort of win on both accounts. It kind of confirms your ideological perspective. For Democrats, it's a lot harder. You know, I mean, there are a lot of Democrats who were upset in 2001 when you know, Senate Democrats and House Democrats basically went along with Bush's agenda. But it's very hard for Democrats to oppose everything that a Republican wants to do because ultimately the Democratic Party is focused on, you know, using government as a tool to, you know, ameliorate social inequities. And so, you know, if you believe that ideologically, it's very hard to just oppose everything. It's hard to imagine if the situation was reversed, the Democrats would adopt a sort of scorched earth economic approach because it's just not the way they approach things ideologically. So I think in a way Republicans have sort of teared out of a very effective political strategy that, you know, not only hurts their political opponents but bolsters their own sort of ideological message.
But something's changed, though. I mean, it used to be that a candidate would win the presidency and the losing side would go back and lick their wounds for 4 years and figure out a better argument and come back and try and win the White House. And to some extent, that compact changed a little under Clinton, that because of Perot, a lot of, I think, hardline Republicans thought that Clinton wasn't a legitimate president. He didn't win by 50%. And you had the Arkansas Project. You had this billionaire Richard Mellon Scaife funding a witch hunt, which ended up finding a stained dress, etc. Then they impeached the guy. But it seems like that from day one they didn't give Obama the benefit of the doubt, even though he was popularly elected by a substantial majority. And then, of course, in 2010, Mitch McConnell famously said just after the 2010 elections, the single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. That's the part of it that I don't understand. It's one thing to declare war on your opponent's policies, but it's another thing to declare war on your opponent.
Well, but it's funny you brought up Clinton, because I actually see a lot of parallels here. To me, this is very much the strategy that Republicans used in 93, 94. They tried to block everything that Clinton wanted to do. Don't forget, the budget that passed didn't get a single Republican vote. They went to try to block health care. They fought Clinton on crime bill and a bunch of other issues. And the result was they took back control of the House and the Senate. So it was a very effective strategy. And you could argue the Republicans just did the same thing this time. They basically said, let's block everything, energize our base of followers, and win back the House. And they did that. The difference, I suppose, is that they've continued the strategy up the last 2 years. And, of course, the other big difference is that the economy is in much worse shape now than it was in 1993. And I think, what's happened in the U.S. is that Congress has become something of a parliamentary body, where it used to have shifting sort of coalitions where you had, Southern Democrats, Northern Democrats were aligned with Northern Republicans. But now it's Republicans basically vote in lockstep, and they vote sort of as a parliamentary bloc in order to prevent Democrats from achieving their goals. I mean, the level of obstruction that we've seen in the last 3.5 years is unprecedented in American history. The use of the filibuster, it's unprecedented. And I think, just to get back to the political element for a second, I mean, I think they have paid something of a price for that. I think people do recognize that Republicans have been obstructionist. And I think, if it wasn't for that fact, I think Obama would probably be losing in the polls right now. I think that's one thing that probably has helped him a little bit, is that, his opponents have sort of showed their hand a little bit. And I think that does help. Whether it's enough to get reelected, I'm not sure. But I think it helps more than people probably realize.
Well, one of the things that I think helps the Republicans in terms of disguising this reality that you just stated, Michael Cohen, is this convention in the press that everything is an equal and opposite argument, that you have to have this so-called balance. And when the Tea Party had that tantrum and threatened to shut the government down over the debt ceiling and destroy the good faith and credit of the United States Treasury, the press reported it as just another Republican, he said, Democrat, she said. So do you think that's a factor? I mean, what's interesting about what you told us is that the public have figured it out in spite of the press.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I think some in the press, the public have realized it. I mean, to be very honest, if the public really realized, who was responsible for this, I think Obama would have approval ratings, above 60%, frankly. So I think I don't think it's gotten through completely. I do think the press, there is an element of sort of wanting to report stories, as you said, as he said, she said. There goes Washington again. They can't do anything correct up there. They can't get anything accomplished. And I think that the nuance of the fact of why that's happening has been lost a little bit. You see, for example, you'll see a story when a bill is blocked in the Senate, bill blocked in Senate, not Republicans prevent a vote from actually being taking place on said legislation. And I think, that's a real problem. And I think more Americans are waking up to it, but is it enough, again, to get Obama reelected? That's what I'm not sure about. I mean, if you think about, I mean, to sound, polemical here, but if you look about, what has happened over the past 3.5 years, I mean, the failure of economic recovery is largely the extent of Republicans, opposing any kind of fiscal stimulus. And it's hard to blame Democrats for this. This is standard Keynesian economics, that you sort of pump money into the economy in times of economic downturn. So, the fact that this race is so close, that it's so badly affected Obama's approval ratings, I think suggests that that strategy works. But there may be limits to it, and I think that's what we're going to find out in November. Is there a point when Americans sort of wake up and realize this has gone too far? And I think also, Obama's helped a lot by the fact that people like him. He's got very strong favorability ratings. I think he has a relatively positive public image, you know, except for the maybe the Tea Party, things are crazy about him. But I think in general, he has a pretty positive image, which I think helps also. Mm. And those are all factors in his favor. Plus, there's also demographic issues as well among Hispanic and Black voters and also among women voters. But in general, I mean, I think, you know, your point about the press, I think, is a good one. I think it's they haven't figured out how to deal with this new reality of governing. You know, they haven't figured out how to cover effectively a political party that is so uniformly obstructionist.
Well, just in closing, Michael Cohen, of course, the clever and cynical thing is that the Republican central campaign theme is that the stimulus didn't work and we shouldn't throw any more good money after bad. And of course, the reason the stimulus hasn't worked is because largely because of Republican obstructionism, and they never even signed on it in the first place, and they managed to con the White House into making a third of it tax cuts, and then and then they didn't even, not one of them signed on after they'd got that deal. So just in closing, do you think if the president, who apparently is genetically bipartisan in his outlook, is incapable of getting really tough with the Republicans, do you think there's a surrogate out there that could?
Oh, I think he will. I mean, I think you know, you saw a little bit of this in the fall and the winter, and it's very funny now. I mean, I don't know if you see this. This is happening now where people are sort of criticizing Obama for running on fear and getting away from his hope message, you know, as if there is not a political opponent out there that he has to deal with who is uniformly obstructionist. I mean, it's a fascinating construct. I think he will get a lot tougher with them because he has to. You know, he can't win on a message of hope. He has to have, I mean, there has to be an affirmative element to his political message, and he has to talk about hope, and he has to make people somewhat optimistic about the future. But he also has to tear down Mitt Romney and tear down the Republicans, and he has to make Americans blame them for the current state of the economy, at least blame them enough where he gets reelected. So, you know, I think people underestimate Obama's ability to be tough and to go after the Republicans, I think, are underestimating him as a candidate. I mean, he wants to get reelected, and I think he'll do whatever he has to do to get reelected. And if it means tearing down Mitt Romney, that's what he's going to do. And certainly it's what his campaign has been doing for the past couple of weeks and months, and I think will continue to do as we get closer to November.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Cohen.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation and a columnist at Foreign Policy, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. And previously he served in the U.S. Department of State as chief speechwriter for U.S. Representative to the United Nations Bill Richardson and Undersecretary of State Stuart Eisenstadt. He was also a speechwriter for Senator Chris Dodd, and from 2006 to 2009 was the senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. He has an article at the UK Guardian, Did Republicans Deliberately Crash the Economy? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about testimony in the Penn State trial of Jerry Sandusky.
Now, who do you think you are? Ha ha, bless your soul. It's a very, very mad world. Mad world. Enlarging your world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now are Bill Mushi, who's a Pulitzer Prize-nominated investigative journalist who specializes in documenting abuses of the criminal justice system. He worked with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for 23 years before becoming a professor in the School of Communication at Point Park University in Pittsburgh. In 1997, he won the National Press Club's Freedom of Information Award for his groundbreaking expose of the out-of-control witness protection program. And Bob Vorjak worked for 44 years as a journalist for the Uniontown Newspapers Incorporated, the Associated Press, and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And he's received awards from the American Society of Newspaper Editors and the Golden Quill Award program for deadline reporting and sports writing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Mushi and Bob Vorjak.
Thanks for having us.
So both of you, of course, must be glued to the trial. And of course, today was the second day of the trial, and testimony came from Mark McQuarrie, who, of course, was the original whistleblower, if that's the right word, some time back. His testimony was pretty riveting, from my understanding, just reading the transcripts of what he witnessed, the skin-on-skin smacking sound as he came into the locker room that night in 2001. I just wonder, what is Sandusky doing while all this is going on? Because this seems like a man that's in the deepest form of denial. Go ahead.
The bottom line is that McQuarrie's testimony pretty much sharply matched what he testified back in the preliminary hearing for the two other guys on charges at Penn State. And basically, according to my the people that have been bird dogging for us, said that they stared each other down for a period of time today, just like McQuarrie stared down Gary Schultz and Tim Curley in a preliminary hearing a couple of months ago. And so far, we've got McQuarrie, we've got two of the alleged victims, and some corroborative testimony surrounding it. But for the life of me, I haven't seen hardly any cross-examination that seems like it goes anywhere.
Well, now, when you mentioned Curley and Schultz, they're the Penn State administrators that McQuarrie called a week after witnessing Sandusky in the shower with this young boy. And McQuarrie also met with Gary Schultz.
Correct. Well, McQuarrie went to Joe Paterno the morning after what he said he witnessed. Paterno went to Curley, and Curley went to Schultz. And then Curley, about a week later or 9 days later, Curley and Schultz met with McQuarrie to discuss exactly what he'd seen. And that's where there's a diverging opinion as to who did what and when.
And, Bob, is this likely to carry any weight? Because it's pretty clear that there is more than a smoking gun here. And my understanding is that while McQuarrie may not have been as absolutely graphic about what he saw when he talked to Paterno the next day, I believe, the coach, he was pretty clear when he spoke to these two school officials shortly thereafter.
When we were doing the research for Game Over, we were able to document and outline, connect the dots, this exact testimony on what McQuarrie saw, what he relayed to Paterno, maybe not the graphic details, but what he saw, and then what he was able to relate to the school administrators sometime later. And, of course, this all happens in 2001, 2002, but yet it didn't come to the public light until an investigation in 2009. So there's that lag time in there, which speaks to what we called the culture of silence, where they kept everything internally and didn't allow outside authorities to look into this until the story got out on its own much later on. So yes, this will resonate with jurors. And I think testimony so far has been clear, it's been strong, and it's been unwavering, both with two of the young men who testified about Sandusky's treatment of them and what Mike McQuarrie said he saw and what he experienced during this time of this Sandusky reign of terror.
And there's been a lot of discussion about that defense lawyer Joseph Amendola has been thrown around since this whole event began, that McQuarrie's story changes all the time, and they had a different year on it and a variety of other things. But from my experience of watching him testify in December and from what I'm hearing about exactly what happened today, McQuarrie was very strong and very eloquent and also stood up to all the cross-examination so far.
Bill Mushy, why is an investigative journalist specializing in crime? What attracted you to this story? This is not the kind of crime beat that you've normally covered.
Well, I have covered organized crime most of my life, and when you look at this story, which, by the way, there's no doubt it's the largest story maybe that has ever come along in the combined 85 years of reporting that Bob and I've been involved in, but the idea that when you look at organized crime activity, according to the law, that's when three or more people get involved in a conspiracy to do something. And the bottom line with this thing is that, as we document in Game Over very clearly, is that people at Penn State campus going all the way up to top administrators had an opportunity or opportunities to stop what is being alleged here as long as 12 years ago. And some people are suggesting it goes back much further. And frankly, there's now that there's new stuff coming out almost every day, it's becoming very clear that many people knew about these allegations and no one did anything about them. And they basically, if these allegations are true, they let young kids fall prey to Jerry Sandusky, if they're true, for years when it could have been stopped.
And Bob Voracek, as a sports reporter, what attracted you to the story and to write, along with Bill, the book Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence? Because it seems to me that it was the way that sports are sort of reported and deified in our culture that really was what was, in effect, protecting Sandusky all along.
Yes, this is a story that crosses the lines between news and sports and college administrations. It's a cautionary tale for any college administrator to read, because once you create that sense of insularity, that the football program makes money, so we're going to let it alone, and it's going to run the way we operate a university, I think you see the dangers in that, and you know the power that's accumulated by a football coach and a football program, and the money that it generates, where the priority is to protect that golden goose rather than to look out for the welfare of kids who are basically invisible because they're underprivileged. They come from the wrong side of the tracks. They don't have fathers to teach them and school them. And you run across an authority figure who basically is a sports icon himself. Jerry Sandusky won two national championships as a defensive coordinator with Penn State, creates this charity with a biblical name, is considered the male Mother Teresa of Central Pennsylvania, and yet it flies in the face of this testimony and these allegations where he really is made out to be a monster who was preying on the very kids that he was sworn to protect.
And indeed, it looks like he created this charity, the Second Mile, as a way to have access to vulnerable kids, boys, young boys who needed a father figure. I take it that you were standing next to the Paterno statue at Beaver Stadium the January morning that Joe Paterno died of lung cancer. Tell me how exploring this story, what has it done to you as a sports reporter in terms of your, you know, shattering your illusions and dreams about something that you've always clearly admired.
Exactly. And we want our sports figures, we want our people to be untainted by anything, but that's really not the way life works. These are human beings with human flaws, and that's the way they operate. And it has been heartbreaking. I even said that part of me died writing this, because when you think about what you thought you knew, the illusion of success and success with honor and the grand experiment of coaching kids not to play football but to prepare them for life, and yet you see what was going on in the dark edges of this, it really is heartbreaking and it's painful. But yet, we didn't create the circumstances, and we're bound by our profession to make sure that we're able to write about it. It's unpleasant, but it has to be told, because sweeping it under the rug is what got him into trouble in the first place.
And Bill Mushey, the co-author with Bob Voracek of the new book, Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence. As a crime reporter, having covered organized crime, you say that in many ways this is analogous with organized crime with the Penn State cover-up. Part of the book deals with the lone Pennsylvania state trooper assigned to the case, and he was able to uncover things that remained on campus for over 12 years under wraps. Tell us about that.
Well, it's one of the classic issues of good old-fashioned gumshoe police work. And the beauty of it was that in 2002, Sandusky was told to not bring any more kids around the campus. he continued to do so, but at least he was told that. But at that point, he went up the road 45 or 50 miles to this place called Central Mountain High School and volunteered as an assistant. And it just so happened that there were some people who became one of the victim one in this case was up there. And when that kid came forward and pulled on Sandusky to his principal, they initially didn't believe him. They didn't want to do anything. But that got the state police involved away from Penn State University, and that's what basically popped this thing over open. And one of the beauties of it is the police officer or the state trooper who busted this story used Sandusky's own book called Touched to track back and find people who now are identified as victims of the thing. So Sandusky, as we wrote in the book, brought the case onto himself through his own words.
But wasn't there also a psychiatrist at Penn State, a woman who initially investigated some of this, and she thought that there was definitely something to it. But then I think a male psychiatrist took over the case and said there's nothing to it. Is that
That's pretty much what happened. There was we write about the interaction between the Penn State Police Department and the State Department of Public Welfare. And in Game Over, we clearly delineate a bunch of things that were not turned over to the Department of Public Welfare, and one of them was the report that you just talked about. In fact, the people at the Department of Public Welfare who are charged with helping maintain safety of children feel like they were sandbagged by the Penn State Police Department and did not get a full record to review before they made decisions that that turned out to not do anything effectively against Sandusky, and several kids have alleged abuse since then.
So, Bob Vorjak, I know we all have a tendency or temptation to indulge in amateur psychiatrics here, but boy, you know, this Sandusky guy is clearly got a deep mechanism of denial. My understanding is that from recent press reports is that his, and particularly you've got to figure from the point of view of his defense counsels, this testimony that's been taking place over the last couple of days is so devastating. My understanding is that his defense attorneys may argue mental illness.
He did introduce a medical issue that Jerry Sandusky has this condition that makes him hyperactive and calls attention to himself, and they're trying to explain away some behavior, which I think personally is unexplainable. I mean, in Jerry Sandusky's own words, which we found out in our research for the book Game Over, he called himself the Great Pretender, where he projected a public image of one who loved kids and helped kids and did everything for these kids, and yet we see that in the testimony that we've seen so far, there's a far different picture of Jerry Sandusky, a sexual predator, a pedophile that used his own charity as a pipeline to groom kids for his own pleasure and to take advantage of their vulnerabilities. So the defense attorney here in this case, I mean, think about what challenges he's up against. I think we all have the same reaction as what we had when Jerry Sandusky appeared on the Bob Costas show on NBC, and he admits to doing some of these things, and you sit there and you're just dumbfounded that he's saying these things, and yet he's trying to defend himself and saying there was nothing criminally involved. It is a classic case of denial, power, and control, and I think he's still feeling some of those things right now as he stares blankly in that courtroom, stares straight ahead, and tries to stay in charge of his own fate.
Well, just in closing, gentlemen, let's start with you, Bill. You know, we've seen a lot of similar cover-ups of sexual abuse, obviously in the Catholic Church. It's still ongoing, I believe, some even in your state as well.
Yep.
There's some important cases going before the courts. You also have cover-ups in the military of an endemic amount of rape of women in the military. What is it about the culture of sports, or is it the male culture of sports we're talking about, that enabled this cover-up to go on for so long?
Well, I think it's the insularity or the closed society that places like Penn State develop over a long period of time. They're the only game in town. They have built up a project through football. They're making $51 million a year. They had a coach there for so many years that he had control over many aspects of the world of Penn State. And when you get this train wreck of things crashing into each other, sometimes people make the wrong decisions, and then they try to, like your mother said, you tell one lie, you have to tell two to cover that one. And I think, honestly, by the time they got to the end of the road here, they didn't know what they originally had done, and they also didn't realize that they, in fact, helped to create a monster, if this is true.
And, Bob Vojak, essentially the same question. What is it, since you're a sports reporter, is there anything about the kind of male culture and adoration and adulation of sports and sports figures that enables this? Is there, I mean, it's obviously not the same as scandals in the Catholic Church. I'm just trying to get a sense of what explains this decade-plus cover-up.
Well, I think there are some similarities in the sense that Joe Paterno, when he ran his football program, drew a blue line around the football field. That meant that the outside world was shut off, and the only thing that mattered was what happened on the football field. That's all well and good when you're competing against another team and you want to be successful. But that same sense of blocking out the outside world also works against you, because all threats don't come from the outside. Sometimes there's that inner threat. And when something comes up and you don't address it and you're not fastidious enough to come forward and let the outside world in, I think that insularity in and of itself enables these kinds of things to happen. I think what you get a sense from Game Over is how isolated Penn State is, not only in terms of geography, but in terms of mentality and culture. And when you set up your own little empire and you're the ruler, well, I think you're setting yourself up for a fall, because tragedies don't happen to small people. Tragedies happen when the people in charge, who are successful in so many ways, have that one lapse of judgment and don't do the right thing.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today, Bill Mushi and Bob Vojak.
Thanks, Ian. Have a good one.
You.
Again, I've been speaking with Bill Mushi, a Pulitzer Prize-nominated investigative journalist who specializes in documenting abuses of the criminal justice system. He worked with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for 23 years before becoming a professor in the School of Communication at Point Park University in Pittsburgh. And in 1997, he won the National Press Club's Freedom of Information Award for his groundbreaking expose of the out-of-control witness protection program. And Bob Vojak worked for 44 years as a journalist with Uniontown Newspapers Incorporated, the Associated Press, and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He has received awards from the American Society of Newspaper Editors and the Golden Quill Award Program for Deadline Reporting and Sports Writing. Together, they wrote Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Quiet boy.